very good. Spoke about last week. Just I noticed something last night, actually, which just happens to connect and draw upon a few things that we've spoken about in the past, so you can't resist sharing it with you. We spoke about, remember, the very beginning, I think the very first week. So we talked about Tosfos on Gimel and Aleph, which asks why it is that certain malachos are phrased in the Mishnah specifically with their detail. We won't necessarily use the word shir. It seems like a shir, but then we saw some discussion if it's really appropriately labeled as a shir or not. So, for example, the Mishnah had listed Hakosei Shnei Osios, and Tosfos raised the possibility that less than two osios is not even a chatzi shir, maybe it's not even called a malach at all. So we talked about briefly at that time the tshuva of the Kachuk of the Rav, that he had a tshuva concerning the circumstance that the person in Europe at that time was conscripted into the army and was obligated upon entering into the army to make a marking with his finger, I think to dip his finger into ink and make a fingerprint, I guess. And he raised the question, if one was compelled to do this on Shabbos, is there a tzad to say that maybe it's somewhat doable or somewhat manageable because maybe it's not even a chatzi shir, maybe it amounts to one letter, one symbol, and therefore that one letter maybe is not even a chatzi shir, maybe it doesn't even qualify as a malach at all, and maybe there are grounds to be made based on that. So at the time we mentioned that tshuva, it happened to be that the Kachuk of the Rav was not overly inclined to be makel based on that approach. We mentioned it in connection to possible ramifications of that Tosfos, but he did not come out overly enthused. Last night I saw that the tshuva's Chazon Nochem that was written by Nochem Liebenfeld, great posuk in his own right, has the exact same shaila. It's a completely different approach, but considers this question as well, the exact same question, about whether somebody who's being brought into the army on Shabbos is a tzad, that maybe we can make it in terms of his making this mark. So his analysis was relevant to what we spoke about last week, to a few things we spoke about last week. So I felt like I just wanted to share it. So he mentioned a few things. One thing he says is that, first of all, it's not exactly kosev, it's called roshein, making a mark, which he's assuming is a tolda of kosev. Now that being the case, since it's a tolda, so he then goes on to say that we also saw the discussion, if somebody is compelled to do something by some outside force, can that perhaps be considered a malacha shemitzri for the gufa? And we saw that there were many poskim who did feel that that was a possibility, starting from the Maharik and others who took this to be the case, that if the army or somebody with a gun to your head or some other type of compulsion forces you to do a malacha, that can be considered a malacha shemitzri for the gufa. So that being the case, he did think that there were grounds, among other sniffing that he brought into the equation, to say that since here the person is being compelled externally to do this, and since it is essentially a tolda, so then he took the view, which we saw was expressed by some that, for example, Nachum Zemba and others have quoted, that a tolda, shei mitzvichu l'gufa, is not a malacha.
Fine. In terms of it being a tolda, isn't there a matama that says that maybe like a design that would like connect another one is the actual thing?
Right, so we'll have to get into that exactly as to what qualifies as kosev, so we're not up to that malachi. I hope we'll get that in a little more detail. But he's working off the assumption, which the Kachuk of the Rav did also, that it's essentially a tolda, and so therefore a tolda together with malacha shem tzrich l'gufa thought that that was grounds to be makel.
Would we still say it's us from being zera d'rabbanan to Rav
Shevet? So zera d'rabbanan, but then if makum great tchak, then it should be mutl, or it should at least be some more sniffing lahakla. Right, so that's totally not mutl achatila, but at least have a, you're correct, and he says it hold the Mishnah Shifu Gufa Bizer Drabana, but would have at least significant grounds more to work with than otherwise. In the context of this tshuva, he also says that that's pshat and Tosfos we talked about on Wednesday, and I'm Gimel Midbeis, the Tosfos Zomer Vitzarach Le'etzin, the requirement of Tzarach Le'etzin, So he assumes as well that what's at play there is the fact that there is a tolda involved. Again, we said on Wednesday that we can more easily see Zomer as a tolda. Apparently, he's considering Kotzer Eitzim as a tolda as well. So because that's the case, that's why even Rabbi Yehuda would require that you need to do it for the purposes of the Eitzim, because it's a tolda she'ena shvicha legufa, which even Rabbi Yehuda would acknowledge would not otherwise be chayav. So if you recall, on Wednesday we mentioned that approach as well in that Tosfos. We mentioned it from the Tshubin Rav, from the Tshuva Dovid Meisharim. So the fact that the Chazon Nochem has the Svara as well is a fulfillment of the directive of Yishai HaNavi Mitzarcha Al Pasale, that one should feel a kinship to his relatives, because the Dovid Meisharim and the Chazon Nochem were brothers. So the fact they both have the Svara is perhaps especially appropriate. So I just felt that that's the truth of bringing together a number of things that we spoke about. The Shaila we mentioned the first week about this army question, together with the Tolda Shein Tzricha Legufa issue, together with him saying the Nespshat and Zomer Vein Sarach Le'etzim. So with all of that, I couldn't resist mentioning that and bringing that to your attention. Hi.
Why is it that everybody just flat out rejects
that Tolda to Tolda? So they're not necessarily, there's two different ways to say a Tolda Shein Tzricha Legufa is not an issue. One way is to say the way Rav Nachum Zenda said it, told it a told the way that it's based on Frank said. So that's one way. And that's against the Rebbe Chanan. Which Rav Nachum Zenda acknowledges, you know, mentions the Rebbe Chanan. But there's a different approach. It's not necessarily saying that there can't be a told it a told, but that specifically a told Shein Tzricha Legufa. Rav Nachum Zenda's approach is assuming that the whole issue of Shein Tzricha Legufa is that that itself is a told. So Shein Tzricha Legufa of a tolda is a tolda of a tolda, is a grand tolda, there's no grand tolda. And we saw that's against Rebbeinu Chanan. However, there's a different way to say it, which doesn't have to take issue with Rebbeinu Chanan. According to Rebbeinu Chanan, we could say, fine, you could have a copy of a copy, you could have a tolda of a tolda. But the issue with the Malacha Shein Tzricha Legufa of a tolda is that they're coming from self-canceling, mutually exclusive perspectives. Because essentially, a tolda shares the function, and a malacha shein tzricha legufa shares the form. So a tolda shein tzricha legufa shares neither the form nor the function, so it loses completely. That's a different way to say it, which doesn't necessarily have to bring you at odds with a Rebbeinu Chanan. Okay, so with that, Hosafa, to now get into a little bit to the sugya of psik reisha. So psik reisha is also a very complicated sugya in a different way. Of course, it is strongly tied in with Malacha Shein Tzricha Legufa. One could argue that it's very difficult to talk about Malacha Shein Tzricha Legufa without inadvertently talking about the Psik Reisha, but it's pretty much definitely going to happen. And hopefully it's Nichole, because of the expense in Yad Gultar V'Yadir. They do inform each other. So us talking about the two sugyas one after the other is, of course, understandable. The Psik Reisha is confusing in a different way than Malacha Shein Tzricha Legufa is confusing. So just to kind of prepare ourselves for what lies ahead, and we are going to try to do this self-contained within this week, and then we'll have to talk about taking some Chazara time, so the some type of midterm Chazara time. We'll talk exactly about how that corresponds to any type of examination, but at least in terms of Chazara, that for sure should take place. So we'll talk about that towards next week, but I do want to contain Psik Reisha within this week. But we should just have some preparation for what it is we're going to be facing here. So today, ideally, we'll try to sketch out some of the territory, and then we'll spend the next few days trying to visit the areas on the map. And essentially, Psik Reisha is confusing for a different reason than Malacha Shein Tzricha Legufa. When it came to Malacha Shein Tzricha Legufa, we saw that there were different conceptual visions of what a Malacha Shein Tzricha Legufa is, and no clear guidance in the Gemara, and therefore the need to work out many different cases throughout Shas to somehow fit one definition or another. And that had a lot of difficulties, and keeping everything straight, keeping every definition accessible and accommodating in every single case of the Gemara is a challenge. In the case of Psik Reisha, it's a little bit different. There, it's not so much that we're not sure what it is. We have a pretty clear picture of what Psik Reisha is, even though there are some nuances that we alluded to last week. But for the most part, Sikh Resha, we understand, is, and again, Sikh Resha is really shorthand. What I really mean is Davar Sheino Miskaven with Sikh Resha. So Davar Sheino Miskaven is an action that causes another action. So I do action A, and it brings about action B. As opposed to a Malacha Sheino Shrichu L'Gufo, which for the most part was, you are doing the Malacha knowingly and with intent. It's just that your intent is different than the intent of a normal malacha. Here, whether a normal malacha is defined by a mishkan or by a positive purpose or by something else, here, it's not that you're doing the malacha for a different reason. You'd rather not do the malacha at all. You're interested only in doing action A. But action A will bring about action B. Or before we get up to saying secretion, we should say might bring about action B. So that's essentially a davar sheino miskaven. So where the confusion comes in is besides the fact that it's a machlokas in the Gemara as to what is the rule for davar sheino miskaven. So we'll see that there's a modification of each position, and there's a modification of the modification. Because Pesach Reisha modifies davar sheino miskaven, Michalei, Lo Michalei modifies Pesach Reisha. And within each view, every step along the way, so you'll have a machlokas rishonim as to what is it referred to. Is it the rice of Rabbanan? Is it about Shabbos? Is it about everything? Every nuance, there is basically a tree that looks like the tax code. So you have essentially step A, and step AB, and step AB1, and AB1 small a, and AB1 Roman numeral 4. So everything has a subject to discussion. Every step along the way, there's a machlokas as to what it's talking about. There's a machlokas as to if it's talking about this, is it only talking about it this way, is it only talking about that way. So to be prepared for a lot of that, that's essentially where a lot of the complexity comes in when we talk about separation. So I hope you were able to get the Marmakomus this morning. Not hope in the sense that you lost if you didn't, but hope that you were able to get it for a productive morning. But essentially, while they're there for your edification to try to see how the different Rishonim express different views here, it is, just be aware, a challenge to try to keep straight every, especially because, as we'll see, there are a lot of steers within the Rishonim. Right? One place, the Tosfos will say one thing, another place will say another thing. One place, the Rashba will seem to be saying something, the next Daf will seem to be saying something else. The Aruch, a major player here, will be quoted in different ways in different places. So even just keeping one Rishon consistent with himself is a challenge. So I would focus, for the purposes of your understanding, or focus not so much necessarily on keeping every detail straight, which again, if you can, in the Yad Vatar V'Yadir, but just to be aware of what every potential distinction might tell us in terms of the understanding of the concept. So the fact that a certain point is in my focus, the fact that something maybe the Rabbanan as opposed to the right, so what does that tell us about the concepts that were involved? And if you can keep straight who says what, more power to you. But just to be aware of what the distinctions are, so what I'd like to try to do today is to call our attention to what some of these potential issues are, and to try to start laying the groundwork for what could be some of the differences in understanding that could push us in one direction or the next. And then over the next few days, then to try to talk about some of the specifics, some of the details that get into Pesach Reisha then uncovers, culminating in a discussion of some of the halacha l'maisa ramifications. That's essentially our agenda, basically, for the next 4 days. So first of all, so the Gemara has a number of examples. I put a few of them on the Marmakomos sheet, but there are many throughout Shas, where the Gemara essentially lays down machlokas, that according to Rav Shimon, davar sheino miskaven is mutter, while according to Rav Yehuda, it is prohibited. Now already, so that calls attention to the fact that you could talk about usur or mutter, shows us that this is different than shogeg. Right? Somebody does something to shogeg, he does action A, and to his horror, sees that action B was triggered. So then that's a shogeg, perhaps. That's not something he had any awareness was going to happen, and that's not something he intended at all. So there's no language of asur or mutter. We talk about shogeg, it means it happened already. So there's no way to say that it's prohibited to do something to shogeg. That's not a It's not an understandable sentence. And by definition, when you have something to show good, you're not asking the Shaila. It happened. So when we talk about us or mutter, so that already orients us, that we're talking about something different. We're talking about you don't want to do it, but you do know that it's a possibility. You do know that this is something that could happen from what you are doing. So therefore, you can ask the Shaila beforehand. You can say, since there is a strong likelihood, or whatever, however you want to evaluate the likelihood, that action A will provoke action B, is it permissible for me to do it? And that's what we call a davar shein miskaven, that we see Rav Shimon and Rav Yehuda arguing about.
I'm just saying, do we consider that in the kavana, if you know that action can occur, even though it's not your original intent? Meaning, do we expand kavana to say that even though you know it's going to occur, even though that's not your real kavana, as opposed to something where you were in an angle?
Right, so another one points to the confusion, which is similar to Moshe Shifra Gufa, is you'll see that we have to either use our terms incredibly precisely or be forced to constantly recalibrate. So to say Kavana, it's hard to say it's called Kavana when even a Yehuda acknowledges the phrase is Davar She'eino Miskaven, meaning that there is no Kavana, yet he does count it against you. So Kavana wouldn't necessarily be the right word in that case, and we'll see there'll be some wrangling about what exactly kavana means. So kavana would probably not be the right way to say it, but your awareness that you could bring about this result means that you have a shaila to ask. And if you're going to tell you, no, you can't do it, but that's something that we're still going to prohibit, despite the fact that it's not what you are trying to do. So you may have seen that you got to see some of the Gemaras, that this is an issue that comes up throughout Shas, because, despite the fact that Shabbos signals come up throughout Shas, but it's not simply a Shabbos issue. This is not only limited to Shabbos. While Malach HaShemesh Gufo was more of a Shabbos topic, this is a broader Kol Torah Kula topic, although it is very intertwined with Shabbos issues, which is part of why you see that there are a lot of distinctions sometimes made in terms of Pesach, in terms of who says what, that you'll have Rishonim saying, well, in Shabbos it's one thing, and Kol Torah Kula is another thing, even though, on the surface, this is not necessarily automatically a Shabbos machlokas. This is an issue that we find throughout. So perhaps most well-known is the example that the Gemara gives, both in Shabbos and in Beitzah, about dragging chairs. And, the Gemara talks about whether or not one can drag a chair outside, so where the likelihood is that that will create a chritz, that will create a furrow, which, as we saw, is a tolda of Charesh. So is one permitted to do that? So Rabbi Yehuda would not allow that because of the likelihood of a charetz. And Rabbi Shimon would only prohibit it if we're talking about a very heavy chair. A heavy chair that's going to definitely create a charetz, or a situation where you're definitely going to do it, but not one that's going to create a, they'll both allow it if it's so aligned that it's going to create a kovesha situation. Is that what you're about to ask?
No, I was going to ask, the word is
right.
Whether it's possible to carry the seemingly rashes. So that
it does have something to do with that. We probably won't get to today, but then there is a whole discussion. Does the sick ratio relate only to this case, or does it relate to how you could deal with the issue in general, even if in this case it's definitely going to come out to be a malacha? So that's a.
I mean, that's like a, not exactly a classic.
Correct. That's part of the discussion. So we probably won't get to it today, but that's part of the discussion as well. Yeah. Hi.
Is it possible to say that your Rishon would be more mocking an answer that it was really a Mokdad Mokha, just because you told that yours were Mokha?
So, to say that, and to draw upon what we just mentioned at the beginning, the overlap from last week, so if one associates Pesach Rishon with Mokha Shem and Shirikha Legufa, which in some cases you do find some of the overlapping terminology, so then it's interesting to try to examine if we want to distinguish between the Malach Shem Tzrich Legufa, between an Av and a Tolda. So should there also be grounds to distinguish in gracious situations is an interesting question, depending on how much of an overlap there is between the two. So maybe we'll have time to look at that. But so far we don't see that carrying over. So far we see that gracious seems to be a different type of situation. Davar Shein Miskaven and gracious get very often a shorthand when they say gracious when they really mean Davar Shein Miskaven. Davar Shein Miskaven and Malach Shein Tzrich Legufa are treated as different. And this Tolda example, which is brought up by the Aphrodim, So far, we don't see it brought up in this context, and we'll discuss a little bit more if that's always going to be the case. You recall from our discussion that of Lakshmi Shrifa Ligufa, that part of the confusion about the whole sugya is when you try to define your terms, it's not even clear which one is more common. And you remember that according to the Rambam, it would seem that Lakshmi Shrifa Ligufa is more common because he's mechayev for that. But he potters for a, at least potters for a Dabur Shem and Miskaven if it's Von Yuchalai, if it's a separation, or if it's not a separation. While in the other direction, one could argue that Segratia is more Hummer if you take the Rav Shimon view, because Rav Shimon potters from Lakshin to Rav Gufa, but is Machayev for Dabur Shem and Miskaven, that is Segratia. So even just trying to keep straight which is more Hummer than the other in terms of our definition, it's part of the confusing element of the whole story. So in any event, so the Gemara has this machlokas in the context of Shabbos, and it has it in the context of a number of other issues as well, which are not necessarily Shabbos related. And I put some of them down the list if you had a chance to look. For example, the Gemara on Daf Kuf Amud Gimel in Shabbos, which talks about Tzitzas Baheres, and that one is not supposed to cut off a Baheres. What happens if you have a baby who needs to have a bris milah, and that baby has a baharis in the place where the bris milah is supposed to take place. So there's a whole discussion, one down from Sukkim, why do we need Sukkim, a whole back and forth, about how that affects the Dabur Shein and the Skavin issue. So clearly that's not a Shabbos issue, and yet it's one of the cases in which this comes up. There is also a discussion in the Gemara Masech HaZvachim about how one brings the Yayin, the Korbanos, and one discussion of sprinkling it over the fire, despite the fact that there is a prohibition of extinguishing the fire. So how do we accommodate that? How do we deal with this action, which is not intended for the purpose of extinguishing the fire, but will likely or definitely, depending on how it plays out, extinguish the fire? There again, you find this discussion, Dabur Shein and Miskaven, and Shein of Yehuda, it's a called Torah Kula discussion. Another major sugya, which I don't think I even put on, we won't get into it today, but I do want to get to it throughout the week, Gemara Maseches Pesachim, some of you may have encountered last year in the second paragraph of Pesachim, about Hana, Yisurei Hana, such as Avodah Zarah, and the situation where somebody is not trying to get Hana from Avodah Zarah, but it's because it's on his way. So to what extent is Dabur Shein and Miskaven and Psik Reisha considerations relevant there? And it's the topic, and I'll hope to have some time to get into a little bit of a fascinating exercise by the Chafetz Chaim in the context of the prohibition of Kabbalah Lashon Hara. So we'll try to get a little bit of that if we have time. But all of that reflective of the fact that, again, on the surface, this is not limited to Shabbos. This is a machlokas that we find Kol Torah Kula. But at the same time, the Shabbos issues might be very affected by local Shabbos considerations. Could be that even though this is terminology that pops up everywhere, there might still be unique Shabbos aspects which are thrown into the discussion. So some of the issues just to be aware of, some of the points that come up. So first of all, in addition to the basic issue in the Gemara, so one question that's debated among the Rishonim is, let's say we were to take the view of Rabbi Yehuda. Let's say we were to take the view that Dabur Shein and Miskaven is prohibited. What type of an Isser is that? Is that an Isser Deraisa or is it an Isser Derabana? So there were a number of Rishonim who understood, such as Rashi and Tosis, that it is an Isser Derabana, which may be a very significant clue, if it's true, into the nature of what this Chiyuv is about. On the other hand, there were those who maintained differently, or at least appeared to maintain differently, like the Ramban appears to maintain differently on Daf Ayin Hey, that the Isser, according to Rabbi Yehuda, is an Isser D'Oraisa. So that's going to be a part of our thinking in trying to figure out what's going on, because essentially what comes out is that it means that Rabbi Yehuda, if you hold it's D'Oraisa, Rabbi Yehuda essentially holds the Eino Mechave, Eino Miskaven element is negligible, is not considered relevant to us at all. It's the same type of Isser as it would be as the tactful intent. So the Isser is Daraisa, then the Miskaven is also Daraisa. Well, if one says it's Drabbanan, which seems a number of Rishonim say, so then that would really redefine things. That really Rabbi Yehuda doesn't hold you really responsible for your lack of purpose here, but that for whatever reason, Midrabbanan, we're going to ask you not to do this, we're going to command you not to do this. And in the context of that discussion, so some of the Rishonim who hold that it gets knocked down to a Drabbanan, so for example, Tosfos invokes Melechas Machshavas in that discussion. So again, the Shabbos component is going to affect things, even though this is not purely a Shabbos discussion. And perhaps you had a chance to see that Tosfos on Daf Kuf Yud Amud Beis, so Dibur Maschil Tamud Lomer, so Tosfos quotes the She'iltas, that the She'iltas wanted to make a distinction in terms of halacha, that our general orientation, that Reb Shimon is correct, that we paskel like Reb Shimon, so just to look at the line here in the middle of Tosfos on Kuf Yud Amud Beis, the Afal Gav, the Kaimelon, Reb Shimon Deshari, Hainu Davka B'Shabbos, Mishum Deboim and Melechas Machshavas. But in the rest of the Torah, Rabbi Yehuda, his view is followed by halacha, and the Reed disagrees. The B'chala Torah Kula, Kaimalan, Karib Shimon, Deshari, and he brings his proofs. So essentially, there we find a couple of interesting points you want to keep in mind in terms of trying to understand what exactly is the nature of the debate here. Even Rabbi Huda's Machmir view is a view of Daraisa, which would mean essentially we're discounting completely the Eidon Miskavim component. Is it only on a level of the Rabbanan, which would mean we are acknowledging Eidon Miskavim, just still prohibiting it on a different level? Does that view incorporate Melechas Machshavas? So is it specifically a Shabbos-oriented idea? And in terms of Psak, the view that Reb Shimon is the winner here, in terms of Psak, so you hear the She'iltas who says that that's only true in Shabbos because of the prominence of Melechas Machshavas, but in the rest of the Torah not. And the view of three, which is probably the way everyone else understands also, that no, even the halacha, we don't make a distinction, and that Reb Shimon is the winner according to, Reb Shimon is the winner of this issue in all areas, not just in Shabbos. Already a number of interesting potential distinctions to keep in mind. So all of that is just before we get into consideration. That's Dabar Shein HaMiskavim. So when you have Dabar Shein HaMiskavim, so you have this machlokas, Reb Shimon will see it one way, Reb Yehuda will see it another way, and some discussion about what we mean by Reb Yehuda seeing it another way, but that itself before we even get into consideration. On top of that, in the Gemara, for example, on Daf Kuf Lamed Gimel, the Gemara introduces these requirements that in order for Reb Shimon to agree, Reb Shimon will agree that there is a prohibition if it is Psik Resha, Psik Resha V'lo Yomus. That if the situation is definitely going to happen, using the example of cutting off the head of a chicken for a toy, somewhat of a debate as to why exactly we do this, and we even discussed last week that there's some who maintain that Psikresha is an expression, but it's not a great example of a Psikresha. Depends whether or not how you define some of these terms, whether or not that would be a Psikresha in Rosh Hashanah Gufa. Taps Tamarin, for example, took that stance that we use this expression for Psikresha, but the actual case of cutting the head off a chicken is not a good example of Psikresha. So that's a little bit less likely, but at least for purposes of an example, since he will definitely cause the death of this chicken by cutting off his head, so then that's an example of an action which will invariably bring about a certain result, and therefore this is considered to be a definite, not just a likely outcome. So Reb Shimon agrees that you're going to be chayiv in such a case. So Psik Resha modifies Davar Shein HaMiskavim. So this is what we're talking about, the tax codes, you know, it's 2A. So even Reb Shimon will acknowledge that the Davar Shein HaMiskavim is a Psik Resha, so then he will be moded. What's he moded to? It's Asr, it's Asr Gabon, it's Asr Dereisa. So again, that'll all depend on what you think Reb Yehuda's view is. But he'll walk over to the Yehuda side if it's a Psik Resha. But we also see from the Gemara overall that even Psik Resha needs another level of modification. It needs to be Nichole. We'll say that very abstractly now because we'll see that there's some variance on this point as well, but there is a condition of segresha of nichle, that it has to be something which is pleasing. What does pleasing mean? We'll see that itself a big debate. And what qualifies? Is this an absolute affirmative requirement, or is this a negative requirement? So this was a major machlokas harishonim, very relevant to lahalacha and to lumdus, which the aruch comes up. And Rashi, if you saw Rashi at Da'afanim Hegemar Aleph, so Rashi has an important position in terms of this nichle consideration. And Rashi says, Rashi is talking about the case where somebody is extracting dye from the chilazon, but is trying not to extract dye from the chilazon. He wants to get the color and he doesn't want to kill the chilazon, but that's essentially going to happen. But the Gemara suggests that he doesn't really want it to happen, that the longer he stays alive, the better. So what does Rashi say in terms of this? So Rashi has an important position that Rashi explains this Gemara. Shadam ha'chai is the bottom of Anheimer Aleph. Shadam ha'chai tov v'dam ha'nei. It's better to have it alive. V'chevin d'kol atzmo miskaven v'tareach l'shom v'shlo yomus b'yado. So since he is trying to keep it alive, so afilu meis ein kan elam misaseh. That's already an important statement, that even if it dies, therefore, the proper assessment of what happens here is misase. V'chimoda Reb Shimon. So the idea that Reb Shimon acknowledges some type of prohibition here, when does that apply? V'midi d'loi ichtislei imis ramei v'mihu ichavne lo mechave. So what is Reb Shimon's agreement here? You could have a middle ground. We talk about nichale and lo nichale. So what if somebody doesn't care one way or another? So where is lo'ichbislei assigned according to Rashi? Lo'ichbislei is assigned according to Chiyuv, according to Isser. That lo'ichbislei is considered to be nichale. That's a very important statement. So in other words, according to Rashi, it needs to be lo nichale in order to be extracted from the prohibition. That lo nichale is essentially an affirmative exclusion. While Tosfos quotes the Aruch, who makes a different important point, that according to the Aruch, segresha lo nichle is mutter. We've referenced that a little bit last week. A very important point, lahalacha, because it comes up a lot. Whether or not it's a follow lahalacha is a little bit of a discussion, but it certainly plays a role in the cheshbonim. So that if something is, even you have what would otherwise be an Isser Daraisa, that's definitely going to happen. But it's lo nichle, it's not desired. So then, according to the Aruch, that is not only not Asr Menatara, it is Mutter. And Tosfos quotes that, and a lot of Rishonim quoted it, but we see Rishonim quoted it in different ways, which adds to the confusion. But essentially, what he seems to be saying is that it needs to be nichale in order to be asr. If it's anything less than nichale, so then it's mutter. Nichale is an affirmative requirement. So according to Rashi we just saw, lo nichale is the standard you need to reach. By default, everything is considered to be nichale. And according to the Aruch, nichale is the status that needs to be acquired. Everything by default is considered to be low nichale. That's a big difference, and that's probably also relevant in terms of trying to understand what exactly is going on here, another issue that's thrown into the mix. Right, so this middle ground, the ichbisle, is a very relevant test case. It certainly has the impact on halacha l'maisa, but also is relevant just in terms of understanding what is it that we're looking at. Are we looking at whether something is affirmatively nichale or affirmatively lo nichale? What's the main standard? What is it that nichale brings something into chiyuv, or lo nichale takes something out of chiyuv, or isser, whatever is the proper terminology? Nichale makes it a problem, or lo nichale makes it okay? Which one is it? So then, to further confuse things in a very significant way, is there were Rishonim who maintained that the Aruch's license for Lo Nichale is only about Shabbos. And there were Rishonim who maintained the opposite. The Rishonim who maintained the Aruch would say this B'chala Torah Kula with Mezalf and Yayin or Dabe Yishim, all the cases the Aruch would say this across the board that Lo Nichale is Mutter. And a further confusing thing is the Rishonim who say these things tend to be the same Rishonim. So, for example, besides the fact that Tosfos occasionally will say something in one place and nothing in another place, and very often it'll be because different Bali Tosfos, here you have, for example, the Rashba. The Rashba, if you saw it, on Daf Kuf Yud of the days in Shabbos, the Rashba maintains this view that the Aruch's position is motivated by Meleches Machshavos, and therefore it's only in the context of Shabbos. And then, on Kuf Yud Aleph Mun Aleph, he quotes in the context of the Aruch a raya that's talking not about Shabbos. And it's worth, if you have the most of Aruch Kuf Mitzvah, to look at the footnotes on both Rashbas and Daf Kuf Yud and Daf Kuf Yud Aleph, where he calls attention to the difficulty there. And as others note as well, the Rush, and the Chazon Ish talks about this also, that the Rush, you have a similar steer. And the Rush in one place, in the end of Shemar Shratzim, seems to be saying it's also like the Aruch, like the first Rashba, that's only about Shabbos, and in Parak Abonai seems to be saying differently. So there is a lot of ambiguity about this point, so just in terms of even trying to keep it consistent within one Rishon at a time. But once again, another element thrown into the mix, the Aruch's view that we affirmatively require Nichale in order to have a problem, and Lo Nichale is Mutter, is that just about Shabbos because of Melachas Machshavos, or is that an issue B'chol HaTorah Kula? Yet another machlokus to throw into the mix. So once you have Reb Shimon, who says he's Moda, the Psik Reisha, so then what is a Psik Reisha according to Reb Shimon? Is it an Isser Menat Torah? And that's the view of the Rambam. And perhaps both Rishonim and the other Rishonim also a part of this list. Or is it an Isser Rabban? The Tosfos Rid, so it seems to be harder to find those who say this, but the Tosfos Rid in Yuma, Baflan Lamedal and Amidbeis, seems to maintain this position that according to Reb Shimon, Psik Reisha, which is Aser, is Aser Midrabban. So it seems to at least not fully depend, but certainly interact. For example, it would be hard to believe that Rabbi Huda holds us in Aser Midrabban and Reb Shimon holds us in Aser Midrabban. It is theoretically conceivable that Rabbi Huda holds it's an Eser Deraisa and Reb Shimon is more than a level of Rabbanan. So in theory, it's not 100% contingent, but there would be certain views that would be harder to say. See, the Lashon of Moda, right?
So this sounds like the Moda is the same
thing. It sounds like it, but it's not inviolable. You could theoretically have somebody say, Moda, yeah, I acknowledge to you there's an Eser. You hold an Eser Deraisa, I hold an Eser Rabbanan, but I acknowledge you shouldn't do it. So I don't know if Moda has to mean that. You're probably right that it most likely means the Pashup shot of the word Moda is that Reb Shimon, in the case of Psik Reisha, Reb Shimon holds the same thing that Reb Huda holds. So that is probably contingent. But and it's, again, very unlikely or almost impossible to say that Reb Huda holds it's, although it's not really impossible. It could be that Reb Huda might hold that in general a Dabrishayim Mechaveim Skaveim is an Issa Drabana, but Psik Reisha is such an overwhelming element that Reb Shimon, who argues in the Stam case, will agree that that's Asur Menat Torah, and then presumably Rabbi Huda will agree that much. Rabbi Huda might hold in general Dabrishayim Mechaveim is Drabana, but Psik Reisha, both he and Reb Shimon holds the rest. So in theory, you could have three different views that maybe Dabrishayim Mechaveim, according to Reb Shimon, is Mutter, according to Yehuda, is Asa Midrabbana, and if Psik Reisha, they both agree as Asa Midrabbana. It's theoretically possible. So there are a number of scenarios in which it doesn't have to directly match, but you're right that the most likely possibility, the simplest way of reading things is that whatever Yehuda holds in general, Reb Shimon holds in the context of Psik Reisha. So that's yet another issue that's thrown into the mix. And then, in that question of what's Asa Midrabbana and what's not, or is it Nisa Dereis or not? So then you have, for example, the Shita Mekubetzes and Ksubis and Davhe seems to distinguish yet again between Shabbos and other things. Maybe Shabbos is knocked down to a Drabbanan because of Melachas Machshavos, and that by other things it is going to remain a doraisa. Possibly relevant to this question, it's interesting in terms of whether you say the isser potentially here is deraisa or not, might have to be, according to Rav Shimon, that psik reisha is what affects things, according to Rav Yehuda, so if it's a possibility already, you have to worry about it. But according to Rav Shimon, you have to worry about it if it's 100% possibility. So how much do you have to keep it away from 100%? So then I'm mechuyev to make a great effort to ascertain that it's not likely? Or as long as there's a 100 possibility that it's not going to happen, then Rav Shimon will be satisfied. So the Ritva, in his commentary to Shabbos, on the Gimel Mideis, has a statement where he asks a question like that, and to make the Gemara work out, it comes out that Rav Shimon doesn't think you have to make such a big deal out of it, that as long as he can hang his hat on a 1% possibility, there's one scenario where it's not going to necessarily happen, so then he's willing to not call that an issur. So does that indicate that it's a lower level issur, that it's not an issur deraisa per se? Not 100% clear, but that's possibly also part of the mix. Gil?
I guess like in terms of that, so when we say like, you know, we open something and a light goes on like in the refrigerator or something like that, we say that the light might have burned out or that part of the electricity might be off. Is that within the realm or is that like way much?
So we'll get to that hopefully over the next few days. One of the things we'll see is that you may, I didn't put this yet, but you'll see eventually a category heading which seems like a contradiction in terms, which is suffix segregation. And suffix segregation seems to be a direct contradiction. The whole nature of the phrase segregation is that it's not a suffix, it's a vada. So how do those terms coexist? So we'll discuss that a little bit. So one way in which they can coexist is that there is a certain metzias suffix. You don't know exactly what has happened so far, or you don't know what a certain reality is, you do know that if a certain reality is in effect, this will definitely happen. If this reality is not in effect, then it won't happen. So that would be a suffix segregation, at least according to some definitions, as you'll get into, but what you just described might be an example of that. So if I know that if the light is working, if I open the light, if I open the fridge, it's going to go on, but maybe it's not working. So if situation X is in effect, it's a segregation. If the variable I don't know is not in effect, then it's not a particular issue. So that's the case which the post can talk about, which we'll get to in the coming days, Gabriel. Hi.
About, in terms of the Ritva, could you have even the slightest possibility that it won't happen with that counter has to be something that you
sounds like in his view of Rav Shimon, and since we passed on Rav Shimon, and presumably his view of Halacha L'Maisa, that you're not required to make it a great suffix, that as long as he has something to hang his hat on that is not definite, that's going to be enough not to be a separation that he asks. So that's probably relevant, you have to figure out exactly how, to some type of understanding of what's going on here. What exactly is suggestive that I want to figure out? Is it relevant to the question whether it's Dereis or Rabbanan? Is irrelevant on some other conceptual level, that's something we'll try to discuss. So with that background, here we're just trying to keep track of what the moving parts are, what exactly are some of the variables. Now we can start trying to speculate a little bit about what's going on here, about what exactly are the different svaras that are at play. So again, just before we put that into gear, so what are the various variables? So we see, okay, machlokes, wethanat, davrshen, and eskaven, is prohibited. Shimon, it's not prohibited. Rabbi Yehuda, it is prohibited. Then a question whether Rabbi Yehuda's view who prohibits it, is he prohibited in the Torah or is he prohibited in the Rabbanah? And is there a distinction between Shabbos and other areas? Maybe Shabbos is Rabbanah, Malach, Mashavis. Other areas, it is in the Torah. How do we paskin? The view that we paskin like Rabbi Shimon, which seems to be agreed, is that perhaps only in the area of Shabbos, that was the position of the Shilchus? Or, like Tosfos assumes in this conclusion, the Tari, is it true b'chol Torah kula? Then we introduce the element of psikresha the nichale, that Rav Shimon agrees. So then the question also becomes, what is the role of nichale there? Leaving the middle grounds unclear, what about lo ichpasle? Rashi and Ayin Hei saying lo ichpasle is grouped with nichale, in other words, lo nichale is an affirmative exclusion, but by default, everything else is considered to be nichale. against the view of the Aruch that lo michalei is mutter, and his view that michalei is the affirmative factor, and everything else by default is considered to be lo michalei. Then we saw the question of even that view of the Aruch, is that limited to Shabbos, or is that by all Usurim? Much confusion about that, even within the same Rishonim, seemingly taking one side on one page, one side on the other page, and the various rayas that are play a big part of the discussion. And then with Shimon's Isser of Psik Resha, is that a deraisa, which is probably the view of the majority of Rishonim, or is it still a Darabanan, which seems to be the view of minority, such as Tosfos Rid in Yuma. By the way, when we get into talking about Halacha L'maisa, we'll see the Taz seems to have different impressions in different places about this one. The Taz that I did put on the list, take a look at it now, but we'll get into the details of those Tazes. We'll talk about some of the Halacha L'maisa situations, where in some places it sounds like he's assuming that the Isser involved is Rabbanan, and in other places it sounds like he's talking that the Isser involved is Daraisa. And then on that question of whether it's Daraisa or Rabbanan, again a possible distinction between Shabbos and other areas, and then also this position of Ritva, that Rav Shimon's view would not require you to really ascertain very strongly that you're not going to create a Malacha, but that as long as it's not a Psik Resha, that's already enough for him to hang his hat on. It doesn't require any greater effort beyond that. So with all those parts in mind, or the possible interactions between those parts, so now let's spend a few minutes in anticipation of the rest of the week trying to figure out what is going on here. What's the nature of this discussion? So at least two things which clearly connect to each other that we're going to want to figure out is what is the nature of Eino Miskaven, and why would Eino Miskaven not be Chayiv? And how does Psik Resha possibly change things, or how does Psik Resha de Nichole specifically change things? So let's set that ball in motion. So who wants to make a suggestion? Why should anyone maintain that a Davar Sheino Miskaven is Mutter? Or Pater, depending on whatever your phrase is. Why should anyone want to take that position? I'm causing a Malacha potentially, especially when we consider, this is something the Chazanish addresses, that I'm not sure I'm going to create a Malacha. Okay, but we're dealing with Shabbos here, right? So what's the normal rule? Something to write Silachomra. So if I'm in any normal area of Halacha, if I'm not sure if something is going to incur a prohibition, so if the prohibition may not tell you, I should be tired. What's the difference between this and the basic issue we have by Sveikis? Sveikis the Reis Lachomra, Sveikis the Rabbanu Lakula. And by the way, Psik Resha by the Rabbanan is a whole sugya in and of itself that we'll get to in the coming days. But it doesn't seem that we could just plug this into a Suffolk pattern of Suffolk the Reis Lakula, Suffolk the Reis Lachomra, Suffolk the Rabbanu Lakula. Which would seem to be a good starting point, by the way, right? What Psik Resha makes something into a Vada? But apparently, it would seem on the surface, very surface-wise, that the difference between Reish Lakish, between Rav Shimon and Rav Yehuda, is just a question of vados. So, Rav Shimon is willing to be machmir, definitely happening, and sounds like Rav Yehuda is taking into account this suffix. But if that's the issue, so why doesn't Rav Shimon also acknowledge that? Sveika derais mechumra. So what is the difference, essentially, here between Eino Miskaven and any other type of subject that I saw? Gil, you want to start?
The main action that you're doing is not the one that's in question.
Okay.
The main action that you're doing is for sure what you're doing. And then the secondary action, you're not even sure that it's going to happen. So it's not the
combination of those two elements.
Yeah, it's not the subject that writes on the actual action. It's the subject that writes on the secondary action. So it might not be like subject that writes on the
So some partnership between those two elements is what gets you off the hook, according to Rav Shimon, I guess. So the fact that you are not, the fact that what you are doing is a maista heter, that's how some express, is that what you're referring to? So you're doing, I'm allowed to do what I'm doing. Okay, so I shouldn't be allowed to because it creates something else? That's a suffix. So what are you saying? Then Sveika, the Reis and Lachomra, only tells me I can't do things that might be prohibited. Doesn't tell me that I can't do things that are mutter that might bring about things that might be prohibited. But then apparently Rav Yehuda says it does. It tells me not only that I can't do things that are prohibited, but I can't cause prohibitions to possibly happen, whether it means my doing something possibly prohibited, or whether it means my doing something else that might bring about something that is clearly prohibited. So keep your explanation in mind. I want to see if there are other explanations, but I'm going to come back to you when we want to then discuss the next phase as to why does segregation make a difference. But let's look for some other explanations first, but keep your answers ready. Yes, Avram.
You're not here without my shepherds.
So,
and what I mean is that if you know if I'm a contractor and I'm trying to build something, and whatever I'm doing may or may not build the building, mm-hmm. I'm not going to get paid for that. I mean, it's not a constructive action.
Okay, so you're providing information why Melechus Machshavas applies, which is helpful or useful in general. We want to ponder what Melechus Machshavas is, so you're not letting us stray too far into assuming that Melechus Machshavas is simply a function of what they intend. You're saying that there is a Melechus Umen translation to Melechus Machshavas. So let's look to what a craftsman considers significant. So since he's only going to consider something significant in terms of what he can get paid for, in terms of something he's doing intentionally, so therefore, by its nature, you would have to say that there's no Melechus Machshavas if the action is not what you are attempting to accomplish. So you're basically saying that this is only going to work for Shabbos issues?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of logic to that. We saw that there was some room that might be the case. Except that it's interesting, there is a comment in the Ritva, which I may not have remembered to put on, I apologize if I didn't, but you should take a look at it. The Ritva in Shabbos, and after Gimel on the base, the Ritva has a statement there that Shabbos, Melechus Machshavas, is the factor here, but that perhaps Shabbos creates a binyanav l'chol Torah kulo. That it's both a concept beyond Shabbos and based on Melechus Machshavas, which is certainly a unique kind of view. One would assume Melechus Machshavas would only affect Shabbos halachas, so here this is kind of an in-between view, that yes, it is Melechus Machshavas at play here, and yet still we can extend this to other things. Very unusual kind of perspective.
Not actually,
because
like once it's significant for Shabbos, so.
Or once it's not significant for Shabbos, it becomes de-significant for everything else, which is, I think, a very surprising type of perspective, but that allows us to have our cake and eat it too, essentially, to say that it's not for Shabbos, and yet still accommodate those contexts that are not Shabbos related. That's what the Ritva asserts. Now, we'll talk about that a little bit more probably in the future. We'll talk about that a little bit more tomorrow, but that's an interesting view to keep in mind. Okay, so far either Maisa is a Maisa Heter or Melechus Machshavas. What else? Any other possible suggestions as to what might make someone off the hook for this? Well, Rashi used the word which might be, Rashi and Ayin Hey used the word which might be relevant, Masaseh. So it doesn't sound like it's exactly Masaseh, but it might be halachically Masaseh.
Right? You're saying it's not Masaseh.
Or you try to do one action and you're not involved in paying any attention to the other actions that are consequential from that action. So then that's normally considered to be misasek. Misasek, you know, for example, we talk about mitzvah srichas kavana. Right? So you could have kavana to have a mitzvah, to do a mitzvah. You could do an action without kavana. Or what many Rishonim assume is a lower level, although the definition blurs sometimes, that it's not only that you're not even having kavanah for the mitzvah, you're not even having kavanah to do the action. So to give a rough example, and the examples are going to be rough because Rishonim do debate as to what falls into which category. Let's talk about mitzvahs. So the Gemara in the beginning of the second parak of Brachos talks about somebody who is reading the Torah, the part where it's kriyashma, and it's zman kriyashma. So the Gemara says, well, if you have kavana, then you could be yotzeh. Oh, so it's a raya that you have to have mitzvah srichas kavana, because the Gemara requires, Mishnah requires kavana. So the Gemara says, well, wait a minute, if you have kavana, but you're reading, so clearly you have to have, you had kavana to read, otherwise you wouldn't be reading. So apparently you need extra kavana in kavana mitzvah srichas kavana. And then the Gemara says, no, maybe it's not a proof, maybe it doesn't show you need kavana's mitzvah, maybe you're just checking the words. So you're reading, but you happen just to be reading because I am looking to see if all the words are here. And check, that's what Kori Levia means, also a debate. So it suggests, let's say, three levels of activity. You could do something with intent for it to be a mitzvah. You could do something with intent, but not for intent for it to be a mitzvah. You're reading on purpose, but not reading for it to be Kriya Shema. Or there's an even lower level, which some of the Rishonim there label as misase, that you're not even trying to read. You're trying to check the letters, and it happens to be that that's also you're reading as you're checking the letters. So while the definitions are sometimes somewhat vague, so you have misase coming up in various places as a very low level of active involvement. There's a connection that is an even lower madrega than no kavana. So perhaps that category is applied here if one assumes that there is no isser involved, that the fact that one action causes another action means that the second action is not what you're paying attention to at all. It's essentially a misase.
So you're saying the fact that you're trying to do one action without intentions for the other action is sort of like what we said, like one shame is sort of the fact that you're doing it for a different intention removes the fact that you're doing it, that it sort of uproots the fact.
It's similar to that, but it doesn't have to come out. It just means that your attention is not at all focused on this action that we're looking at. That the action that you're doing, the action that's the potential malacha here is completely incidental. Now, you're right, why is it incidental? It's incidental because I'm paying attention to something else. So there is that overlap to what we said in malacha shem shiach l'gufa. I don't know if you have to have that element. It's just the focus is on the lack of focus. The focus is on the fact that this malacha is done completely incidentally. It happens to be that, yes, if you're distracted by something else, then it's more likely that it's going to be incidental. But to give another example in terms of Hilchos Shabbos, so if I forget that it's Shabbos and I turn the light off, so then that's shogeg. But if I don't even turn the light off on purpose, I'm just playing around with things, I'm just distracted while I'm thinking about the weather, and I happen to be playing with stuff on my desk, and I reach out and I turn the light off without thinking about it at all, so that may not even be a shogeg. You know, that's, you know, misasa, well, I'm going about my business, not paying attention at all, so then that could be a very low level of chiyuv. In the case of the shogeg, I knew I was turning off the light, I just forgot that it was Shabbos, or I forgot that Shabbos prohibits that. Shogeg is a greater level of involvement than misasa. So again, assuming that the terms are translated correctly. And we'll probably discuss tomorrow, Kiga Eger has a tshuva about misasek in general, b'chol Torah kula, where he understands misasek a little bit differently than others. It's a tshuva in Siman Ches, so we'll get into that a little bit more. But for the most part, misasek is a relatively low level of involvement. It's interesting, just al pi darach hadrush. So la'aso is considered to be a high level of involvement. We're talking about Berachas HaTorah, so there is a whole discussion of the proper nusach should be the topic of in the Gemara. We say make a Berachas HaTorah la'aso the Divrei Torah, al Divrei Torah. So there's some discussion. Does la'aso mean that you are even more engaged? You know, a person is mafalpel, is ma'ayim, as opposed to just reading, or does it mean that everything you do throughout the day that's Torah related, even if it's not actual learning, but also lasso, still some vagueness into what lasso means in that context. Is it a more active engagement? Is it a less active engagement? So here, misasek, you're involved. You're involved kind of without, you're involved basically on autopilot. Autopilot would probably be a good definition for what misasek is. So essentially, what a possibility here is that, okay, so you brought about a malacha, but I mean, you have to say that you have enough awareness of it to ask the shayla, and that's why we have the machlokes. But your awareness is that it's so tangential to what you're doing that maybe the halacha would use it as misasa. And then you have to figure out, we'll talk about this probably tomorrow, whether or not it qualifies for the definition of misasa, or whether or not it corresponds to the halachas of misasa. That's itself an issue. So that gives us another possibility. Okay, so your action is an action of hetter, or your action of isser is misasik, or meleches machsheves is what takes you out of chiyuv here. Maybe meleches machsheves we could even expand beyond Hilchos Shabbos, possibly, a very surprising view. Any other ways of saying it? Any other ways of getting somebody off the hook for redemption and scavenging, Sammy?
It's like their rest is over.
Ah, so we're doing it's an interesting view. Even if that's true, so what Sammy's alluding to is that this is machlokas was shown in and of itself. But the, if you, hopefully, since the rule is you're all past 17, so hopefully you've all read the Sheva Shemaisra. See your eyebrows go up. The author of the Ksos HaChoshen wrote the Sefer Sheva Shemaisra, supposedly when he was 17. I think he may have. Right, Sheva Brachos Torah, one for every night, Sheva Brachos. So one of those nights, the audience picked me to take notes, and I think that's pretty impressive. But so he wrote this for Sheva Brachos. So it's two lessons there, when you should get married by 17, and you should write the Sheva Shemaisra by 17. But I think he quotes it later as far as this, so he must have revised it at a later age also. But I guess on some level, this was written when he was 17. The three svarim that we have from the Ksos, so we have the Shmaisa, the Ksos, and the Yavne Miluim. The Yavne Miluim was published posthumously. It's like a little bit of a different style. We brought the print by his son-in-law. So the Ksos is his adult sefer, and the Yavne Miluim is his posthumous sefer, and the Sheva Shemaisra is his teenage sefer. So each one's a different tkufa. So the Sorry, right, exactly. This is the Hellas and the Shemashir. So the Shemaisa, the Mashkifim say, if the Ksos can write it by the time he was 17, we should at least read it by the time he was 17. So the midterm on the Shemaisa will be tomorrow. But one of the Shemaisas he talks about is he talks about very complicated things. But one of the things that Tzvot Sevni is addressing is that he talks about the question of Sveka Daraisa L'chumra, that we're obligated to go L'chumra if we're not sure on a matter of Torah law. So the question is, what is that din? That rule, Sveka Daraisa L'chumra, is that a rule min haTorah? In other words, the Torah requires obedience even to Makom Sapek? Or should we say no, that the Torah doesn't require you to act to Makom Sapek? Chazal put this into place. Chazal set this distinction between, either way it's probably the case, Chazal set the distinction between their law and Torah law. But Chazal said, one of the dinim we're going to make is you should be machmir on Sveikus min haTorah, which then probably would make it a type of a siyag. And we don't want you to violate definitely Shurim min haTorah, so we'll tell you not to violate Sveikus baraisa. So let's say that's the Rabbanan. So would that really help us here? Because
yeah,
still, why we have to still distinguish it from...
Yeah, because we have not what exactly the Rabbanan would be trying to do. Or you have to show on, you would say that there's, you know, it's a double shame of scapping. You know, as a siyag, you're not trying to do that. Meaning the siyag is only when you're trying to do something that would be very similar to the action that could get possibly get you to that point. But he doesn't care. About, it's not
lichale. That's actually very interesting. That's a very interesting perspective. You hear what Sam is saying? I wasn't thinking along those terms, but that's a fascinating idea. And maybe you're right. This is a classic spirit of isolation. And Chazal made the gzeira of spirit of isolation. So when did Chazal tell you to be machmir? They told you to be machmir, not to do something that is a possible issue deraisa, but not to cause something that's a possible issue deraisa. Maybe they didn't kuli high, they weren't gozer, which itself makes a lot of sense, especially it's a fascinating story. See anyone who says that? That's your suggestion? Okay, there's a lot to explore within that, because you could say that, so what are we worried about? So we're worried about that you'll cause something. Right? So assuming this whole chiluk between Rav Shimon and Rav Yehuda, since Rav Shimon agrees with his psychiatria, so the difference between Rav Yehuda and him is that Rav Yehuda's afraid you'll cause something which itself is a suffix isur deraisa. And that is, or actually the suffix is in the causing. He's afraid you're going to cause something which is definitely
the
right.
The siyag is to try to prevent you from doing the arisa. So according to Rabbi Shimon, if you're doing something that might cause something else, why would you don't want that to happen.
It's essentially a too far of a remove.
Exactly, it's too far of a remove. But according to Rabbi Hudi, he says no, that's meaning the fact that you're going to be caught, that may cause the action to come out,
people still might make that mistake. They might say, oh, okay, so if I can do this, that can cause that, so sometimes I can do that. What's the difference?
But would it still come out that what he's afraid of is a Rabbanan? Because if we're afraid that, if we want to say that the whole issue is the Rabbanan to begin with, right, so then it's easy to say that Chazal are not going to create a Rabbanan when
the
concern is the Rabbanan. But they're not going to tell you not to do action A, which might lead to action B, if action B itself is the Rabbanan.
No, the action is
so here,
Rabbanan
what's action
because B? It causes it. The action that's caused it, if it would, done the appeal, would be done alone, is a Daraisa. But not the fact that you're doing it separately. Now that's what makes it a Darabana. I mean, that's the Ali's answer. Okay. He says that, you know, let's say you would turn on the light in the fridge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a Daraisa, perhaps, right? But by opening the door, you're not turning on the light. You're opening the door. That's a little bit different. So that might only be in your
Rabbanan. So that itself is your Rabbanan. And a suffix of that is a suffix of Mr. Rabbanan. Your Rabbanan and your Rabbanan.
Correct.
Interesting.
That's what Rabbi Shimon would say, but Rabbi Yehuda would say it's all the same thing. We're trying to prevent somebody from doing the Daraisa. It's the same Rabbanan. Meaning, it's not. It's just one Rabbanan saying, make sure not to do anything that might confuse people to turn on that light in the fridge. One way is by not opening the door.
Okay, very interesting. Could be. It's definitely something to explore. But there's still another element which I'm not hearing from anybody. For example, the Sri Aish expresses this view, which also is a view that has a lot to be explored. If you want to look at some of the Sri, there's different printings of the Sri, but it's at least one printing. I think the most current printing is in Chelek Aleph and Siman Lamed Zayin. And he says that essentially, you are disconnected from this action. That perhaps for a maisa to be connected to you, it requires intent. And if you're not trying to do it, so then your lack of intent makes you separated from this maisa. And therefore, we can't prohibit you because you are not connected to the result. So then, like I said, the second phase of the question, after you establish all our theories as to why Eino Miskaven is off the hook, then we can now figure out how separation changes things, and each of them will have its own exploration. But that's just the first level of the question. So maybe once you have no intent, so then that keeps you apart from this action, and maybe Rav Shimon's view is that you cannot be connected to it in order to be prohibited.
But in that case, doesn't it sort of seem like we have to say it's like partially gone right then, and nothing to do it?
Might be that that's the case. We don't know that that's not true. We don't know under what circumstances. So as part of the any position you want to come up with, someone's going to say, we're going to say it's a Rabbanan, it's Mutter, it's Mutter on Shabbos, it's Asur in the week, it's Mutter in this case, it's Mutter according to Shirin, but you'll find every permutation. So it could be that's true. So that's another theory. So what does that give us so far? So what have we seen so far? That either your Maisa is a Maisa Heter, so we have to just look at what you're doing, or it's Blachas Machshavas, or it's Blachas Machshavas even according to other Yisurim, or it's a Sveika Derabbanan because the whole issue is a Derabbanan to begin with, or there's no connection to the Maisa because it's not what you want to do. Lack of intent is a fatal flaw in terms of your connection on a total level to something. What you find in other areas of Halacha as well, in Hilchos Shavuos, I think the Sri Yesh references this at the Gemara's expression, Ha'adam b'shvua prat la'ones, a person is only considered to be a person in the context of his accountability for his oaths, if he wants to make the oath. So there's a identity as an individual. When you get very philosophical about it, it's hard to stick you into the equation unless you want to be there, unless you are there on purpose, which has all kinds of philosophical implications. The Kula and Mechumra, feel free to ponder that. Yes?
A lot of times when someone wants to do something that's against the court, they always like,
saying, well, this comment just now about Adam B'Shua,
yeah,
the assumption is that there was Adam here, this was his avos, on behalf of everyone. There was
the same Torah for Shua that would be for all other men, but also?
For a normal Shua, but the Shua is the Torah, so we work off the das of the ancestors at Har Sinai, so the das is there.
No, I mean, so if their das was only for something that was intentional, so any mitzvah.
Or you want to then say as far as that they had a condition in their das? I think that would be a different level of lack of das, because Yeah, they had a das for whatever's in the Torah. We don't have any source that says that they were able to accept the Torah in a traditional way, that we understand it this way. The general shua biyad, the person takes on his own shua, so there is this statement that the Gemara has ha'odom, the shua, klatlam, and he requires a certain level of connection. Okay, so now let's take this question to the next level. So then, with our various understandings of what Dever Sheinu Miskaven is about, so why does Psik Reisha make a difference? This is a labored question. Right? What does Psik Reisha accomplish? You may be familiar, some of the Achronim pick up this issue. It's a comment that the Bochonim has in the beginning of Subas. Chazanish, Chaim will talk about. This is a major topic. Why is it that Psik Reisha makes a difference, Jonathan?
So if we say, like what Gil was saying before, mm-hmm. that doing action license, I think Rizal Kesef Mishnah, mm-hmm. where it said that the Psik Reisha, the point is that by doing action A causing action B, you're really doing action A and B at the same time. So
right,
you're,
okay.
The Shabbat wouldn't apply to that because you're really doing
it. Right, okay, so that's a very important point. So the Kesef Mishnah is very much a part of this discussion. Even though within the Kesef Mishnah you can still go probably in a few directions. But essentially, and you can probably still open up the question just as much as to what exactly that means, but Jonathan is correctly pointing out that the Kesef Mishnah was explaining the difference between Psik Reisha and Melacha Sheinu Tzricha L'Gufa. And we mentioned at the time that everyone jumped on him because it sounds like he was explaining it in a way that Melacha Sheinu Tzricha L'Gufa would come out more chamer. So then we said, well, that's fine, because he's commenting on the Rambam anyway, and the Rambam holds Melacha Sheinu Tzricha L'Gufa. But many tried to explain what he meant, why he would say that Psik Reisha is more chamer. Because the problem was that according to him, so Psik Reisha, you have no intent at all. Melacha Sheinu Tzricha L'Gufa, you have intent. But the intent is for something else. So why shouldn't we say then that Melacha Sheinu Tzricha L'Gufa is more chamer? How could it come out that Psik Reisha is more chamer? So the way in which it works, we mentioned the Kajibu Ever to this effect, is that what the Kesef Mishnah means, as Jonathan's reminding us, is that the Kesef Mishnah means is that the Kavana of intent, the fact that you choose to do this, is grafted onto the Malacha. So A and B become joint actions. So you have the Malacha through action B, and you have the intent through action A. And now they're connected. So, we still have to speculate as to what that means, but let's try to go through our various theories. So, in terms of, let's say, Gil's suggestion that your maisa is a maisa of hetter. So, we could say, well, not anymore, because you have a compound maisa. So, your maisa now is now both. Because somehow, how does that happen through Psik Reisha? Then we still have to explain that. So, how does Psik Reisha make these two actions into a compound action when they weren't compound before? What makes it was just as much one action before, right? Let's say we look back at what happened after the fact. So two people did something; they both ended up causing a malacha. The second one was particularly shikaze; the first one wasn't. So they both are equally linked actions. What is it about psikration that makes the action more connected than a lack of psikration? Sammy?
Because, for example, let's take the case of Mila.
Yeah.
When, even though technically you can separate the two actions of cutting off the Baharis and cutting off the Orla,
mm-hmm.
but when you have one action of cutting and both results are happening, it's the same thing. Meaning, since it's so integrally connected in the action, if you have no kavana for it, so then you might be able to theoretically say, okay, so technically they could be two separate actions, you know, and you really don't. This result that he doesn't really care about, or it might not even be good for him, so therefore we can say, oh, fine, so he really didn't mean to do it, so he was really doing something else. But where it's instantaneous, it's impossible to separate the two, so therefore you can't really, same action.
So it is the same action, not that you want it to be the same action, but that it is the same action.
Correct.
Okay, Jonathan?
So if you say in retrospect that it would have been the same, so the double Shemus Kavan actually happened, physically, it's the same as Psik Reisha. The only thing that's different in the case is that maybe Kavana, that Psik Reisha could have had maybe more like subconscious Kavana.
You'd think so, although not necessarily. It's interesting. The Achronim, such as the Bochanan, such as the Chazon Ish, and maybe we'll talk about this a little bit more tomorrow. But the assumption is, they posit at least two different ways. Maybe we could still say three ways to understand what the Pesach Reisha connection is. But there really is a difference between the two of them if you think about it. But on the one hand, we could say that Pesach Reisha means that, let's answer the question that Jonathan just asked. Right? Jonathan just said, if, let's say, after the fact, they both learn about malachas, so what possible difference after the fact is there between the case where it was definitely going to happen and the case where it wasn't definitely going to happen, but it happened anyway? So, says Jonathan, well, it must be the only possible difference is that you're awareness of it. Right? So therefore, it's got to be a kavana issue. That's a very logical statement. It's not necessarily the only way to see it. There are many who see it that way. And there are many who say that essentially, for example, the Chazon Ish expresses it this way. And if you want to look it up, it's the Narei Chaim Siman Mem. And it says that the fact that you know something is definitely going to happen, you can no longer say, and this is important, the point for Chinuch, also your kids argue something was an accident, this comes up a lot. If they know something was going to happen, they can't absolve themselves of responsibility for it. You can't say, well, that's not what I was trying to do. Also, in terms of law, civil law, if something is completely foreseeable and inevitable, right? So negligence could be broader, but part of what we vote against you in the lawsuit is, if something is foreseeable and inevitable, right? You knew it was going to happen, and it had to happen. Right? But now I'm just saying that negligence is broader. It could be, I was careless and something didn't have to happen, but it happened. But something that will be argued against you if you're sued for some type of damage. Right? This reflects two elements that are very much against you. Foreseeable and inevitable. So you could have figured out this was going to happen, and it was definitely going to happen. So if that's the case, the fact that it wasn't what you were interested in is not going to help you when you get sued in civil court. And so to here is what Jonathan's reflecting, that maybe it's got to be a kavana issue, and if you knew it was going to happen, and there was no possibility it wasn't going to happen, you no longer can say it's not what I was trying to do. I don't care what you're interested in, the fact that those two elements are there, it connects you inextricably to this result.
Well, I think that it might be difficult with the ritual that we saw, that he said that you can call something that was just out, even if it's like 99%, if there's like a 1% shot that that would happen. According to that kind of line of thought, that maybe it has to be like less than a 50% chance.
In terms of, let's say, the example from that civil liability, when you're getting sued, you're right, if you say, well, there's only 1% chance, you're not going to get such a sympathetic jury. Right. But maybe in terms of the abstract concept, maybe it might still be true that maybe it has to be 100% in order for us to make the statement that, but you're right, the Ritva is debatable in terms of this. And the Ritva probably does inform our concept, our conceptual thinking one way or another. But strictly speaking, I could view this, I could understand this in a strictly 100% way. But let's think, is there another way to see it? Yeah. Let's think of this as another answer to this question, because Sammy was really saying something else. And let's ask Jonathan's question again. Right? If the only difference between case A and case B before, and the two cases where we could look the time the day after and see they both provoked malachos, so the only difference was that one case it was definitely going to happen and one case it wasn't definitely going to happen. So Jonathan said, well, that the only difference between the two could be your kavana, your knowledge of what was definitely going to happen. Is there another possible way to distinguish? Is there another possible significance? So what you fill in the blanks there. Is one action doing what?
If it's definitely going to happen, then the only thing that could separate the two actions from being the same is the fact that one might not.
Okay.
If it definitely happens, then they are, by definition, the same action.
Okay, so essentially what Sammy's saying is that any time one action has to bring about action B, then they're automatically connected. Not because you want them to be connected or because it creates your kavanah. even if, let's say, you were not aware of this, but if the reality is that they are 100% correlated, that makes them into one action. Because the truth is, you could always break down any action into smaller parts. What connects one action to the other, or what makes actions divisible? So presumably, if you could stop at some point, so then an action is divisible. But if you can't separate the two, because one action always brings about a second action, so then maybe those two have to be considered the same. So therefore, you did action A means you did A, B, you did them together. So that is going to be a fundamentally different definition, because then your kavana will play a different role. So for example, the role of nichale here. If you focus on kavana specifically, so then nichale is another element that you want to do, okay with it, that exacerbates it. Again, especially with your kids. When your kids say, well, I wasn't trying to do that, but I knew it was definitely going to happen, and it was completely foreseeable, and I'm happy it happened. So again, you have a very hard time divorcing yourself from reality. But if you say it's one action, then the nichale is much harder to explain how it plays a role at all. And you're certainly going to have it limited. So for example, only actively low nichale, but not necessarily anything beyond that. And even low nichale, we're going to have a hard time explaining it. So that itself, already two important ways, and the Chazon Ish, for example, maintaining the Kavanah Svara that Jonathan said. If you look at the Chazon Ish, it's a little confusing, because the Chazon Ish is worth reading. So the Chazon Ish is often difficult to read. Here it's just a little bit difficult. I mean, his words are pretty clear, but just still a little difficult. Because he starts off saying that he thinks that there's a Malachash and Yitzrichu Lagufa connection. But essentially, it's a Malachash Mashav and it's a Malachash Yitzrichu Lagufa issue. That the lack of Tzigreishu, or Tzigreishu Zonichule, rather, say within the Aruch's view, so that is going to be a Chisaron in Malachas Machshaves, is going to be similar to Malachas Yitzchak Levi. But then he asks on that it doesn't seem to be limited to Shabbos. It seems to be applicable to the philosophy. So then he goes on to say that on top of the Malachas Yitzchak Levi issue, there's also the issue that a lack of intent is essentially a lack of any connection to the Meisah. And it's only a psik ratio of the Nichole that makes it as if you are a Mechavi. And by the way, this expression is in Rishonim. I put on the Arachomos, Rashi and Sukkah. And then Bami Gimel uses this expression. If you got a chance to see it, if not, you should have to take a look. And the Ritva also quotes a very similar language. That in a case of psik ratio of the Nichole, it's Ilu Mechavi. So it's not just the Chazon Ish who brought this up. You have Rishon who essentially seem to be saying the Svara, that's what happens, essentially what Jonathan was saying. So these are two important approaches which are going to have nafka minas in terms of which is dominant, is the issue that psik ratio infuses you with kavana whether or not you want it, or is it's not so much about kavana, but that it links your actions. So there's a little more to say about this. We're just out of time, so just to give you a little bit of a preview for tomorrow, the Pekafka. So the important Chaim about this, and it also addresses the Shabbos Shahar Torah issue here. And we also have to figure out, is it possible, maybe a little bit of a third approach in this equation, that maybe it's not so much a logical conclusion of either of the two types that we saw, maybe it's a custom, it's a din in the Torah that psik ratio creates a certain linkage. And if you had a chance to, how far did we get from our room? Did anyone, I'm not far away, did anyone get halfway through? Okay, so you have a lot of space left. So you'll see towards the end of the first sheet, I'll give you a second sheet as well, but towards the end of the first sheet, you see some other possible areas where psik ratio logic is used, where it's not
only and not only about Shabbos, but it's not necessarily even about Isur, just other Torah concepts where the logic of segregation is invoked, which may give us a little bit of an insight into this type of activity. So we have to talk about that. We'll talk about the Reb Chaim, maybe some related points, and then we want to get into then some of these details of suffering segregation, segregation by the Rabbanan, segregation in various circumstances. That should take us through the next, say, 2 days, and then we'll talk about some of the halakhic ramifications. Any questions? Any issues? Everybody doing okay? Okay, so again, just keep broadly in mind the various nuances in terms of how the machlokas plays out and how the psak plays out, and then we have various theories as to what's at play here and why it should be that a davar shena maskaven might theoretically be disconnected from you. And then, how does the situation change the equation? We saw various theories which somehow broadly correlate to some of these suggestions. Everyone should have a fantastic day. We'll see you guys at Shem tomorrow morning. Anyone who's running a marathon or running a marathon should be here late. You have a good excuse. Or cheer. I'm sure they grant credit for that. Even more than 26 miles.
We have a meeting next week.
Sorry?
We have a meeting next week. We have a meeting.
That Sunday, you mean? Yeah.
It's not anymore. What?
We don't have an meeting
today. Today's marathon day.
We don't have an
meeting. Schultz said she wasn't needed for that.
I understand. Yeah. Go cut off somebody's head. Mm-hmm. But next week, you could have been the day of the minion.
Why?
You could have been the day of the minion.
Unfortunately, I guess it's not there. It's happening in the checks.
I don't know if it's